This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Recently, a close friend of mine experienced an unexpected loss. Watching their family struggle emotionally and financially made me stop and think seriously about my own family's future. As the primary provider, I know how important it is to make sure that if anything ever happened to me, my family would still be able to manage. So I realized that without life insurance, my family would be left with overwhelming financial burdens. I looked into coverage before, but the process always felt complicated, got endless forms, phone calls, and medical exams, made everything take weeks. So that's why Ethos stood out to me. Their process is simple and 100% online. There's no medical exam required, just a few health questions, and you get a quote in as little as 10 minutes. In many cases, you can even receive same-day coverage without ever leaving your house. Ethos offers up to $3 million in coverage, with some policies starting as low as $2 a day, billed monthly. It's a trustworthy company that's changing the way people think about life insurance. So protect your family's financial future with life insurance from Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Brian. That's ethos.com/Brian. Application times may vary. Rates may vary.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Moving forward with a lot of balls in the air as we get closer and closer to Christmas. Michael Watley's going to be with us. Not only am I going to find out about his North Carolina run is going, I want to get his expertise on the RNC, who are getting a series of wake-up calls, I think, in some off-year elections that are not going their way, special elections that are not going their way. We'll talk about all that and, of course, take your calls. So before I open up and tell you what's actually happening today as we try to keep a few things going on, including we also know that Kristi Noem is going to be on Capitol Hill. The HHS secretary always creates some controversy, especially with her aggressive immigration tactics that really have ticked off Democrats. They'll use that opportunity to go after her, go after Trump through her, and more. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Immigration among Latinos. He is 38 points underwater. That is a 36-point shift, essentially, from where we were a year ago on immigration. In their mind, he is doing something absolutely wrong when it comes to immigration.
Wow. Harry Enten of CNN. Are the sweeping immigration crackdowns hurting the GOP and the Hispanic community? Judging by the recent elections, the answer is yes. A prominent GOPer. Peers are starting to see major warning signs for the midterm elections and trying to get the president's attention.
Number two.
As you probably know, we've just seized a tanker on the coast of Venezuela. Large tanker, very large.
Maybe the biggest.
Largest one ever seized, actually.
Maybe the biggest ever.
It was seized for a very good reason.
Yes, it should have been sanctioned, should have been stopped, and it was going to Iran. We will take the tanker. Thank you very much. That's what the U.S. forces did yesterday off the coast of Venezuela to amp up the pressure on the illegitimate dictator Nicolas Maduro, who must soon realize he's got to go.
Number one.
If they want a plan with a cheaper premium on the Obamacare exchange, we're just saying you want a lower premium and money for your health care up front, choose ours. You want a $6,000 premium, choose theirs.
That's really what you're talking about. $6,000 deductible. Senator Bill Cassidy, a doctor, healthcare crunch, an array of fixes from both parties, but no one plan to pass on the countdown to Christmas looms. Why I think the GOP has to get something done. And President Trump, just pick a plan, get behind it, and I think you'll get the momentum to get it done. Personally, in fact, a couple of Democrats have said that. Now, I think the Democrats want this issue next year, yeah, but it's a year away, and there's other people that are not that worried about the election, like Josh Gottheimer, trying to work out things with Brian Fitzpatrick, who are in the Problem Solvers Caucus. So roughly, there's a couple of things happening, which I don't understand if Democrats are against. I've never heard a Democrat go, I really want to get insurance companies richer. I believe their stock prices on the major insurance companies are up 1,000% since Obamacare came into fray. So right now, the money goes directly to insurance companies. What Bill Cassidy's saying is, why don't we put it to a healthcare sharing, health savings account? And they can only spend it on health, and there's ways to regulate that. You could set these up, and it would go. It affects 28 million people. It's a lot. It's not everybody, but it's a lot. But most people, doctors included, don't love Obamacare. Why? The major companies have bowed out of it. Cigna out, Aetna out, U.S. Healthcare out. They don't want a part of it. They're losing billions of dollars. So they said, we're off the exchanges. So there's no competition. And there's $6,000 deductibles. So the other one that was brought up is let's extend the subsidies for a year. And Brian Fitzpatrick and Josh Gottheimer brought that up. And if you extend the subsidies for a year, they will curtail the amount of people eligible because they were expanded during the pandemic. They'll crack down on fraud, which has been identified by the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post over the last few days. And in turn, they were promised to get something worked up for next year in order to get something bipartisan going. Now, why did I say bipartisan? Because you can't get anything done. Nothing's going to stick. Republicans could have a plan that you and I think is brilliant. But as soon as Democrats take an element of the power, whether it's a House or it's the White House or Senate, they're going to start tearing it up. And we saw that with Obamacare over and over again. But I think both sides agree they got to get something done. It would be a mistake to not. Ben Shapiro even brought that up. Is there anyone more conservative than Ben Shapiro? Here's what he said. Cut 10.
If Republicans are going to try to do a solve, what they actually should do is they should probably boost those ACA subsidies for another couple of years, but include a bunch of riders that transition it out and make way for larger HSAs. In other words, provide people some sort of glide path toward a new future as opposed to a hard stop. Hard stops in American politics typically create massive political blowback, and 2026 looks like it's going to be pretty ugly for Republicans anyway. So on a principle level, I totally understand why Republicans are saying don't continue the ACA subsidies. But I also understand that the political blowback is going to lead to Democrats in power in 2028. And Republicans who are pretending away the vulnerability that they have electorally here are missing the point.
So is there anyone more conservative than him? Did you ever hear him say anything good about Obamacare? I have never seen any Republican say anything good about Obamacare except for originally Mitt Romney, then went against it. But what he's saying has got to be practical. And so many people aren't political. And they just say, wait a second, who's president? I voted for this guy. Now my subsidies are going away and I got to double the amount I'm paying. So they didn't get into this. They were forced into it. They had to take it. Their company doesn't offer it. So they're on Obamacare and now the premiums go up, but the deductible stays the same. So just extending the premiums is what Democrats want. But to try to fix it, what Republicans want and some Democrats want. Pete Aguiar came out and says, he signaled that Wednesday that Democrats could be flexible if the three-year extension fails. Says we're willing to have conversations, and members are having conversations right now. Susan Collins, Roger Marshall, and Senator John Husted are also having conversations about coming with some type of cooperation. So, see, John Thune likes the Cassidy plan. I think so, too. And I just don't know. Usually you know when it comes to abortion and things like that. You know where every Democrat stands. You know where every Republican stands. When it comes to the border, same thing. But when it comes to insurance companies, I don't think they're for it. So I want to get your take on this. I think Republicans have to make a deal, and I think Democrats, there's enough of them that would. 60 votes in the Senate you need and some type of agreement in the House. And I think you got 2 weeks to do it. So in immigration, we know the administration feels very prideful of what they did in the border. I do, too. I love the fact that they've gotten 630,000 illegal immigrants out of this country. I love it. But knowing that 8 million came in during the Biden administration, many more during, you know, over the last few administrations, but especially Biden and Obama, that there's a long way to go. But because the optics are so terrible and because in many cases they're coming off way too aggressive, the Hispanic community is getting really turned off. And if you want any proof of it, look at the polls. And if you want further proof, look at Miami. First time in 30 years, a Democrat was elected mayor of Miami. Really? Then you saw how the Republican got trounced for the governor's race in New Jersey and Virginia. Howard Enten says the numbers don't lie. He's on CNN. Cut 23.
If you know anything about Miami, you know it's heavily Hispanic, heavily Latino. And what we have seen is that Latinos have absolutely gone up and said, you know what, I don't like what Donald Trump is doing. I mean, just look at Donald Trump's net approval among Latinos. In February, it was minus 2 points. Not too hot to trot, but not that bad either. Look at where it is now. Minus 38 points. That is a shift of 36 points in the wrong direction, the completely wrong direction for Donald Trump. And what the race in Miami illustrates, I was looking at the localities, locality by locality by locality. What you see is these huge shifts in these heavily Hispanic neighborhoods of Miami against the Republican nominee.
That's CNN. I get it. But Howard Enten, just going by the numbers, he's right. Cut 24.
immigration among Latinos. He is 38 points underwater. That is a 36-point shift, essentially, from where we were a year ago on immigration. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are basically tied on the issue of immigration. And now on the issue of immigration, Latinos despise, hate Donald Trump. 38 points underwater. In their mind, he is doing something absolutely wrong when it comes to immigration.
So that's the numbers. So the president knows numbers. He's not an ideologue. Has to realize that the stuff is not working for him, even though the objective is right and the mission is clear. The way they're going at it, and the reports are people just being grabbed off landscape trucks in some cases and out of Home Depot parking lots, is not what the Hispanic community wants to see. It might be what you want to see, but the ones that want people here legally just don't like the way some of these families are being broken up. So that's the problem, why it's so much more difficult to get them out once somebody irresponsible like Joe Biden let them in. And I saw the mayor of Dallas. He's African-American. He got elected as a Democrat immediately. So he was so fed up with the party with Joe Biden in charge, he became a Republican. And now he made it his effort. He's head of the Mayor's Association to get more Republican mayors across the country. Mayors usually in cities, in a lot of cities, it's extremely tough. So he came out and he basically says, this is a warning sign. It's a warning sign that things are about to get worse. He calls, Eric Johnson does, that this is a wake-up call. He said the wake-up call to all Republicans beyond the Latino majority Florida city, which, by the way, they lost. He says no sugarcoating it. They had a really bad they're really bad for the party. A lot of what's going on with the rounding up of his mostly Hispanics. He said this: the Democrats got very involved in the Miami mayor's race very early and put a ton of money into it, particularly once the primary was determined. I think we got outspent 19-1. Republican candidates run differently in this environment when Trump's on the ballot and as opposed to when he's not. And we've got to figure out as Republicans how to win when he's not on the ballot. When we come back, I'll take some of your calls, 1-866-408-7669. I do want to tell you about Venezuela as well as Ukraine. Both those things are moving rapidly. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
How could this escalate the conflict with Venezuela?
Well, you know, we've had sanctions on Venezuelan oil since the first Trump administration.
And Biden kept them.
Kept them.
Yeah.
So to me, this is absolutely normal. I mean,
seizing an oil tanker?
Yeah, we've been seizing Iranian oil tankers in the past. We also, according to the law that I've read, that oil is up for forfeiture. So we could keep that. We've kept Iranian oil in the past. I think this is actually a pretty, you know, check the box case.
Mm-hmm. Love it. I love it. So the sanctions are there. We all admit as a country, Venezuela is a huge problem in their government. They're a poison. They're a cancer in the region. Because they're keeping their own people hostage. 8 million have left that population. The guy is an illegitimate leader, and he allows communists to run wild, like Cubans, like Russians, like the Chinese, like the Iranians, and specifically Hezbollah. And he puts them throughout the region. Why would we tolerate this? Now, I was talking to Senator Sheehy on television, and he didn't say regime change was the goal. He's smart about it, but he's the type of guy that would understand fully what it would mean for U.S. security. And I know, after Libya and Iraq, and people know regime change, it's never that smooth. No one's going to say it's going to be easy, but nobody thinks that this guy is legitimately leading. My hope is he leads with his golden parachute and goes somewhere else. Annie Linsky from Wall Street Journal, a special report from the Wall Street Journal, weighed in on where Venezuela is going. Cut 15.
Absolutely is ratcheting up the pressure on Maduro, and that is the underlying result of this extraordinary action today. You know, the timing is no coincidence. You saw the Nobel laureate, the woman who has stood up so strongly to Maduro, left the country yesterday, and that gave the United States a little bit room to do this. But this is a moment where the United States government is getting stronger and stronger on Venezuela, but has not really made a case yet to the American people about exactly why these types of things are happening.
Right. That's Annie Linsky. He's right. I don't think to the American people, they just say, hey, by the way, this is why we're blowing up the drug boats and Maduro's a problem. But there hasn't been an Oval Office address because I think the president on some level just hopes to do this covertly, transparently, but covertly. And the thing is, I think behind the scenes, I hope the CIA is working it out so they recognize the military leaders and who controls the military, controls the country. So here's more from Annie Linsky, cut 17.
This is sort of opening up another front on this pressure campaign against Maduro and really hitting him in his pocketbook. So you have this sort of military threat, but also cutting off this sort of oil pathway of funds is going to make it even more difficult for him to hold on to power. And that is absolutely what the administration, in my sense, is what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and that is a plan. But do you want to make a plan and tell the Gang of Eight, for example, that Maduro is getting him out as the option? Here's our plan to do it. And maybe they keep their mouth shut. Or are you going to just continue to talk about the September 2nd, second strike needed to kill off that boat and blow up that boat that was full of drugs? I love this now. Oh, it's just coke. It's not fentanyl. It's just coke. Since when is it just coke? I mean, pours out of Colombia, goes through illicit means of Venezuela, off the coast it goes, out to the Caribbean, up the coast, up the American coast, the East Coast with us, and then over to Europe. But Europe was an ally. They make money. In the case of many of these regimes, the terrorist regimes, they target the West whenever they can and use that money to do it. We've seen that before. There's a ton of Democratic criticism on this. And then there's MAGA right, who say, well, the president promises not to get involved in other, long-term, endless wars. He's always getting involved in a war. But I do think the next thing will be, if Maduro doesn't leave, blowing up the drug sites. And is someone against that? Cut 17. Cut 17. Okay. Let's go with cut 18.
This is the way, if you want to put pressure on Maduro, I mean, this is the way to do it. If you're killing the drug dealers and then you're cutting off sanctioned oil and not allowing them to use these ghost tankers to get oil out of Venezuela to China or somewhere, that will do big damage.
And Iran. Iran is, remember, they're heavily sanctioned their oil, but if they're able to go back and forth with Venezuela in it using the same tankers to the two of the evil alliance, that hurts America's credibility. So it all works together. I love that we're moving, making a move. First time, really, since I've been at Fox, that we really are showing interest and sustained interest in what's going on in Venezuela. For the most part, the American people just say, well, that's a problem. They send their gangsters here. Well, that's an issue. I love it. Pam Bondi said she kind of oversaw the whole operation. According to Donald Trump, and after talking to Pam Bondi, he thinks we're keeping the oil. He goes, I assume we're going to keep the oil. For a country with the world's biggest oil reserves, losing a tanker only tightens the squeeze, they say. That on top of 20-plus strikes and a controversial follow-on hit that was Congress demanding the tape, all amid the narco-terrorism fight that Trump is putting additional pressure on Maduro. You know what else I think helps? And I think the message is getting to Mexico. Because, you know, we're supposed to re-up the USMCA, fix it, make it better. And we're not really talking to Mexico and Canada these days extensively. A little bit of frustration from the Trump administration on our side. Yesterday, Sheinbaum, the president of Mexico, said we're putting a 50% tariff on Chinese imports and on specific goods on top of that. You know who also has that policy? Us. And you know, if you want to do a deal with the U.S., that's what you do. You show you're tough on China. My hope is that Sheinbaum calls up and then it will also help our business because we do so much trade between them. We get Canada together. We get this done. You put it through Congress while it's still in Republican hands. Not many people are against the USMCA, against NAFTA. There might be some changes for Democrats to get the 60 votes. We'll see. When we come back, former RNC chair turned Republican candidate for the new North Carolina Senate seat, Michael Whatley. Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And I'm not the ones giving Donald Trump a grade. It's the people themselves. Last night, while Donald Trump was mocking affordability in Pennsylvania, voters in Georgia and Florida gave him a big fat F. In Georgia, just 1 year ago, Democrats lost that state House district by 22 points. Last night, they won it. We've had the first Democratic mayor in Miami in 30 years, what used to be a Republican redoubt. Those elections are another warning shot from the ballot box.
That's nice of you, Chuck Schumer, to look out for Republicans to make sure they understand that they're not having good off-year elections. I do think Miami, they put a lot of money into Miami. They put a lot of big name Democratic names into Miami. And for the first time in 30 years, there's a change in party leadership in the mayor's race. Michael Whatley joins us now. He ran the GOP for a while. He's now running for the Republican nomination for the North Carolina Senate seat and wants to get that seat and flip it. Michael Whatley, welcome back.
It's good to be on with you, sir.
So, Michael, your thoughts about what you picked up from the Miami election?
You know, look, I think the fact is we've got to go back to basics and we've got to talk about what the voters care about. We got to talk about the issues that they care about. We've got to put solutions on the table. The Democrats are riding, you know, the typical special election and midterm election wave that always happens where the party that has the White House, you know, has to deal with, you know, the support that comes to the other side. But I'm not worried at all about where we are with the midterms, because the fact is that Republicans right now are digging out of this trench. President Trump is digging out of the ditch that Joe Biden put us in and the Democrats put us in.
But there's the one difference I would have, and I played this for our audience, but I'd like you to hear it. The CBS did a poll, and the one thing that's pretty consistent is you worked so hard to gain in the Hispanic community in a way that Mitt Romney, John McCain, and even George W. Bush didn't think was possible, to the point where I think Democrats are saying, well, we took them for granted, we kind of blew it. But now you see that the numbers are suffering for Republicans, and a lot of people are pointing back to the aggressive immigration policies, not at the border, but elsewhere. I want you to hear Harry Enten on CNN talking about the CBS poll. Cut 24.
Immigration among Latinos. He is 38 points underwater. That is a 36-point shift, essentially, from where we were a year ago on immigration. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are basically tied on the issue of immigration. And now on the issue of immigration, Latinos despise, hate Donald Trump. 38 points underwater. In their mind, he is doing something absolutely wrong when it comes to immigration.
So, your thoughts?
Well, President Trump is doing what he said he was going to do. President Trump said throughout the course of the election last year that he was going to shut down the border and he was going to remove violent, criminal, illegal aliens from the United States. That is exactly what he has done and exactly what he is doing. I can tell you in Charlotte, North Carolina, we just had a stabbing this last weekend with a violent, criminal, illegal alien who stabbed another man who's trying to protect a elderly woman. We don't want these people on the streets. We don't want them in our cities. And the president is fighting to be able to remove the violent criminal illegal aliens from the country, just like he said he was going to do.
Right. But do you think that if people are being picked up off the back of landscaping trucks that really are here illegally but haven't committed a crime, do you think in the Hispanic community that's interpreted as going too far?
Look, I think the biggest thing that we've seen is that President Trump shut down that border. Joe Biden allowed 15 plus million illegal immigrants to come into the United States, hundreds of thousands of them captured at the border. They were determined that they were felons, mm-hmm. and they were still allowed into the United States. These are people that absolutely positively have got to be removed. You know, the highest priority for the government, for any government, federal, state, or local, is protecting its citizens, right? My opponent, Roy Cooper, is absolutely got an F when it comes to protecting the citizens of North Carolina. He has vetoed bills to force sheriffs to honor ICE detainers and move people out of the state, which is why we have to have, you know, ICE come into Charlotte through Operation Charlotte's Web and be able to remove these types of criminal illegal aliens. So, look, we need to keep our kids and our communities safe. That's what the president is doing right now across the country.
So when with Charlotte, how is that being received by the people of Charlotte? Mostly a blue area. And we have the horrible record of this guy with dozens and dozens of criminal activity, some convicted, some not. Lenient judge lets him out. And then he basically throws lights a woman on fire randomly. So,
yeah, look, I mean how is that being received? We talk about that. The crime issue in Charlotte and frankly, in all of North Carolina is the number one issue of the day right now. And obviously, the economy is going to continue to be a top issue. But the fact is that Roy Cooper signed an executive order in 2020 when he was marching around the block with Antifa, with BLM during the 2020 riots. He signed an executive order to reimagine law enforcement in North Carolina. We don't need to reimagine law enforcement. We need to enforce the law. You know, he set up cashless bail, he set up pretrial release, and he set up a revolving door that has allowed these criminals to be back on the streets, despite the fact that they've been arrested 20 mm-hmm. times, 30 times, 50 times or more, and it poses a direct threat to the community. The people of Charlotte, the people of North Carolina, want their kids and their communities to be safe.
So what issue is the number, let's say, what are the top three issues to the people of North Carolina?
Yeah, I think right now the top two issues are going to be the economy and they're going to be community safety. And my opponent, Roy Cooper, has an F on both of those, right? Donald Trump is fighting to rebuild our economy. It was absolutely in the ditch after Joe Biden. We had 34% inflation over the course of 4 years. Housing prices doubled in 4 years. Health insurance costs skyrocketed. Interest rates skyrocketed under his watch. And so it's going to take a while for us to get our economy back on track. President Trump is fighting all day, every day to make sure that that's happening. And then the crime issues, which are extraordinarily real, because my opponent, Roy Cooper, has made North Carolina a haven for criminals, a haven for illegal aliens. And we need to move back on that.
So, yeah, we'll see going forward. Michael, do you think the RNC is in good hands?
Yes, Joe Gruters is doing a fantastic job, and he has really focused on the same things that I was focused on, which is making sure we're in a position, the RNC is in a position to get out the vote and protect the ballot. He was a winner in Florida. He did a fantastic job turning that state from purple to red, and he's going to do a great job managing here at the RNC.
So I want you to hear the big debate on Capitol Hill is health care, and they want to see if they get something done before the end of the year. Here's Mike Johnson, Chuck Schumer, Thune and company going back and forth. Cut two.
There are two parties in this town. One has no intention and no plan and no desire to lower your health care costs.
I want to be very clear about what this Republican bill represents. Junk insurance.
A tour of fantasy land narrated by the Democrat leader.
The Republican Party, on the other hand, is already demonstrating that we know how to do this.
We're going
to
have another couple of votes tomorrow where we're going to see chaos and no plan on health care.
Drill that down and bring that conversation to North Carolina. How close are the people of North Carolina watching this? How many roughly are affected by the subsidies put in place during the pandemic?
Look, health care costs in North Carolina are the highest in the country, and we've seen them explode during the 8 years that Roy Cooper was governor. We also have seen them go up dramatically since Obamacare was passed. You know, the Democrats said you could keep your doctor under Obamacare. They lied. They said that health insurance costs would go down under Obamacare. They lied. The fact is that during Joe Biden's tenure, during Roy Cooper's tenure, health care costs have absolutely gone through the roof. We need to bring health care costs down.
Got it. Michael Whatley, thanks so much. I think a lot of people would feel better if you run the RNC, but I thoroughly understand that you want to make sure you're the next Republican to win the North Carolina Senate seat. Michael, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
All right. And at Michael Whatley to help him out on his campaign. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, we'll have full slates of guests. Also, we're going to open up to about Ukraine. I got the latest. A lot of things are happening in real time, so I'll update on that and then squeeze in some calls. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
With the holidays coming, that means more gift buying and more deliveries to the front door. It made me think about how I should upgrade my security to keep away the porch pirates and keep my delivery safe. I went with SimpliSafe because it's proactive. Traditional systems react after a break-in. SimpliSafe can help stop a crime before it starts. That's because SimpliSafe keeps your home safe with a double layer of defense. First, you got cameras detecting potential threats, and then live agents confront them while they're still on the outside of your home before they have a chance to do any damage, telling them they're on camera and telling them the police will be dispatched if they do not leave. That's right, if they don't leave. That's why I trust SimpliSafe at my place to help protect my family, keep an eye on the dogs, and watch those deliveries, because real security stops crime before it starts. Right now is such a good time to get SimpliSafe. This month only, get 50% off any new system. Go to simplisafe.com/Brian. Again, that's simplisafe.com/Brian. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This is not the book you'd expect me to write. Nobody's story is tidy, and I'm no different. A lot of people look at me, the stark white shirt, the blue suit, and yeah, the gelled hair, and they think, oh, I know this guy. I know this guy better than I'd ever want to know him. I get it. This is a story of a kid who always felt like he wasn't quite enough. This is a truly vulnerable book. It was incredibly hard, even painful, to write.
That is crazy. That is the governor who wants to be the next president of the United States, who's done a terrible job as mayor, terrible job as governor. Case in point, look at Pacific Palisades. Not one house has been rebuilt. I don't think a permit has been let out. You have a city that falls apart, homelessness running rampant. You have a huge deficit, a pledge to give insurance to every illegal immigrant in the state. Now that's rolling it back. I mean, he's for open air. Drug use, so we could give drug addicts clean needles. I mean, this is the guy, and now he's putting out a biography he wants everyone to buy. What's crazy is that Gavin Newsom is moving up in the polls. They say his approval rating in California is up 8 points. It might even be out over 50%, but he's produced nothing good. Do you know also that gas prices are the highest in the country in California? And you know why? They've shut down all their refineries. They had as many as 50. Now they're down to 8. And 2 of their biggest are going offline, which means they're getting 65% of their oil from Iraq and the Middle East, which is a huge carbon footprint as opposed to a short trip when it comes to carbon use, because this is all about green technology. Now, this guy was the one who said, we're going to stop selling gas-powered cars by 2030. Do you know there were more gas-powered cars in California than any other state in the union? It just blows me away. Now he wants us to read his backstory and pretend he didn't grow up rich. I mean, that's like Mitt Romney coming out and going, I only had a few million dollars. I mean, imagine if Donald Trump came out and said, I really struggled as a child to make ends meet. You'd laugh. I'm laughing at this guy. I do not get. How he's leading. Look, I always thought that if you wanted to be successful in politics or anything else, you had to do good at your current job. You know, you don't become president if you weren't a good vice president of a company. Just logic goes to tell you. So, I mean, look at other people in time. You know, you have somebody who hasn't been president. Most people have never been president before. So General Eisenhower in the 50s. Why did I think he'd be a good president? Well, why wouldn't he? Supreme Allied Commander, marshals all our nations together in order to win the most decisive war and the biggest war in world history. Good enough for me. Harry Truman. from a vice president to president, shows himself with the courage to drop the atomic bomb, bring our country back, stand up to Korea and fight back and push back against the rise of communism, probably would have got elected again. Go back to, let's say, if you look back in history, even Richard Nixon, what did he do? Well, you might not have voted for him. You might not like him. But man, he was experienced. He was governor of California. Remember that? Vice president of the United States. Hey, I'm going to run for president. And he wins. Okay? Qualified. Look at George W. Bush. You might not have voted for him. I did. But George W. Bush was a successful businessman. Didn't win every race he entered, but did win twice in Texas. And by the time he ran for president, I think he had a 56% approval rating in the state. It makes sense. Why would anyone look at Gavin Newsom and say, that's the future of my party? I know he looks the part, but think about how all over the place he is. He says, I'm going to start a podcast and show I want to listen to the other side. And next thing you know, he's on social media pretending to be the anti Donald Trump character online. Which one is it? Want to bring the country together, hear the other side? We just want to be a typical anti Donald Trump guy. So I'm not getting that book. But if Kamala Harris is going to put out a book, who's one of the worst candidates in history, and looks like she's going to be brawling with Gavin Newsom for the nomination, she got nowhere else to go. We'll see. Now, here's a few other things going on in politics. And I love this. Ted Cruz came out and says, I got a problem with the Republican nomination in Texas. Love Wesley Hunt. I've voted for and campaigned for Senator John Cornyn. And he's even friend with Paxton, the attorney general. Cut 40.
That I don't know. They're both friends of mine, all three. Wesley Hunt, all three of them are friends of mine. I've endorsed all in the past. I've campaigned with all in the past. And I'm going to trust the voters of Texas because I have terrific supporters who are backing each of the three. And the voters will decide. But whoever wins the primary, they're going to beat Jasmine Crockett.
Yeah, we'll see if they beat Jasmine Crockett, who now is going to be using her money that's pouring in order to become a Senate candidate. And there's reports that maybe some of the polls that were out that showed Crockett has a chance of winning were put out by Republicans, hoping that she would throw her hat in the ring, because Colin Allred was a lot more formidable to Ted Cruz than Crockett will be to whoever emerges on the right in Texas. So they got to fight for everything. They're going to fight for Whatley's seat. That'll be big. They're going to fight with Scott Brown and Sununu's brother, John Sununu, up in New Hampshire. I think these are going to be big fights. I think to keep the Senate seat Republican, Joni Ernst's Republican seat in Iowa, is not going to be easy. Flipping the most vulnerable seat in Georgia will not be easy if they don't pick the right candidate. So this is going to be tough all the way around. So I think it's going to be quite interesting. For the midterms, things aren't trending the Republicans' way. But that's usual. Remember, 63 seats Barack Obama lost after his big win over John McCain. And he was never really able to get Congress back. Remember, he jammed this all down our throats when he had just about he had 60 votes in the Senate. Think about that. And then they lost Ted Kennedy's seat to Scott Brown, got to 59. And they had to just get one Democrat Republican. They couldn't do it. But the midterms, traditionally, outside 2002 after the 9/11 attacks, go to the other party. Donald Trump knows it. He was asked about it yesterday, cut 39.
When you win the presidency, you seem to lose the midterms. Even if you win the presidency by a lot and you do a great job as president. You know, some presidents have done good and they've lost. I think it's like two times in the last many, many years it's been one. I don't know why. It doesn't make sense. Usually I can figure things out, but I don't know why, but that seems to be. But other than that, we should win because we're doing great.
Yeah. Well, it's all about producing in the second half of the year. And finally, I want to talk about Ukraine. The president of the United States is getting fed up with Ukraine, calling for elections. I don't know why he's fed up with Ukraine. I know he and Zelensky don't see eye to eye in a lot, but it's really not their fault. I mean, they're sitting down talking about giving up land that Russia hasn't won, talking about having elections, not having any security guarantees with NATO troops or allies on the ground. I mean, it seems like the only thing that Zelensky is doing is playing ball. But the president of the United States doesn't feel like that. I personally feel like Russia has shown no ability, no willingness to give on any portion of this. Here's the president yesterday, cut 42.
They would like us to go to a meeting over the weekend in Europe, and we'll make a determination depending on
what they come back with. We don't want to be wasting time. Sometimes you have to let people fight it out, and sometimes you don't. But the problem with letting people fight it out is you're losing thousands of people a week.
So you lose about 7,000 a week, and the Russians are losing a lot of it. Do you know what they're also losing? Their ghost ships that are allowing them to illegally ship oil around the world. These Ukrainians are brilliant. Now they have these underwater devices, mini submarines. They're blowing up the tankers before they know them. So the Russia shadow fleet is in the crosshairs. And Lavrov came out yesterday, praised Donald Trump's approach to potential settlement. He says the only Western leader who understands him. However, he does point out that he's increasing the sanctions on Russia. That according to Reuters yesterday. He also threatened Europe if you continue to give them weapons, he's going to go after you with nukes. I got news for you, Lavrov. You know who also has nukes? Most of Europe. UK, France. They'll use them if you use them.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to 40th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. We're two blocks away from the Rockefeller Center tree. We got our own tree right here at 1211. It's become a big destination for tourists around the country, around the world, with the number one news network on the planet. Josh Krosshammer is going to be with us in about 35 minutes. He's going to bring us inside politics and the electoral reality over in Texas, what they should learn from Miami and the mayor's race. They went to a Democrat. And we're following Kristi Noem's testimony. They, of course, are going to look to light her up because they don't like her aggressive immigration policies. I'm talking about Democrats and maybe some Republicans, but she's always been a lightning rod. And of course, if you want to get to the president, you go through the cabinet members. We'll follow that. And things pop up, we'll be sure to bring it back. Michael LaRosa, former special assistant to President Joe Biden, chief spokesperson for the First Lady, former First Lady Jill Biden, House Democratic leadership and U.S. Senate communications director will be with us shortly. But first, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Immigration among Latinos. He is 38 points underwater. That is a 36-point shift, essentially, from where we were a year ago on immigration. In their mind, he is doing something absolutely wrong when it comes to immigration.
Well, the sweeping immigration crackdowns hurting the GOP and the Hispanic community. Judging by Howard Enten of CNN, the answer is yes. Judging by the recent election, the answer is yes. And one prominent GOPer in Dallas, Texas, says these are warning signs and a wake-up call, Republicans.
Number two.
As you probably know, we've just seized a tanker on the coast of Venezuela. Large tanker, very large. Largest one ever seized, actually. It was seized for a very good reason.
That is President Donald Trump. We will take that tanker. Thank you very much. That's what the U.S. forces did yesterday off the coast of Venezuela to amp up the pressure on the illegitimate dictator Nicolas Maduro. Where's this heading? I'll weigh in.
Number one.
If they want a plan with a cheaper premium on the Obamacare exchange, we're just saying you want a lower premium and money for your health care up front, choose ours. You want a $6,000 premium, choose theirs.
That is Senator Bill Cassidy, former doctor, health care crunch, an array of fixes from both parties, but no one planned to pass as Christmas deadline looms. Why I think the GOP has to do something. And Michael LaRosa joins us now. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
No problem. Don't you believe that Republicans have to do something on health care?
I think they do. I think the problem, though, is that none of them voted for Obamacare in the first place 15
yep.
years ago. And so they're not ideologically inclined to want to do anything. And that's okay, except they're going to have to answer for the subsidies expiring. And you're seeing nervousness under people like Josh Hawley, who wasn't there 15 years ago, saying, like, we need to do something. We need to do something. 20 million people, I think, get their insurance from the Obamacare exchanges. But the majority, vast majority of Americans actually get their health care from their employer. But it does affect a certain population of people who will feel some pain. I'm not somebody, like, I don't believe either party really has clean hands here, because nobody really did anything about the expiration until about a couple months ago.
And the whole thing is,
this was going to happen.
And the whole thing is, too, with Obamacare, everybody knows Republicans were trying to get rid of it forever. And Barack Obama had a lot of fun with that and just said, oh,
it's
you
like
guys.
Kind
just,
of like,
yeah.
Yeah. Elections have consequences, right? We have to win elections if we want to be able to dictate how we want to govern. We shouldn't expect them to do the things we want them to do from the minority.
So a couple of things. So we have Senator Peter Welch, Democrat from Vermont. He says he believes that the president has to get involved. He has to pick a plan, get behind it. He says because right now both sides just have like rival plans. Senator, here's a little of the back and forth. You got Chuck Schumer, Thune, and Johnson. Cut to.
There are two parties in this town. One has no intention and no plan and no desire to lower your health care costs.
I want to be very clear about what this Republican bill represents. Junk insurance.
A tour of fantasy land narrated by the Democrat leader.
The Republican Party, on the other hand, is already demonstrating that we know how to do this.
We're going to have another couple of votes tomorrow where we're going to see chaos and no plan on health care.
So the Republicans will have first the Democrats are going to vote on theirs, which is just extend the subsidies for 3 years, and which were put in place during the pandemic. And the Republicans are going to say, yeah, take that money, but put it into health care savings accounts. And let's talk about getting rid of fraud and changing the eligibility requirements. So I don't know. They're both going to fail, right?
Fail. Yeah. They'll be side by side bills today. They're both going to fail. I mean, and then on the other side in the House, I think that's where the politics is more interesting because you have two discharge petitions going to the floor, which is where the minority can essentially force the Congress to vote on something. One's led by a Republican from Bucks County, Brian Fitzpatrick from Pennsylvania. The other, Josh Gottheimer, a Democrat from New Jersey. But if you look at all the co-sponsors, Brian, they're all moderates. They're all Republicans or Democrats in vulnerable seats. And I think as sometimes when you take a step back, that's where the deals tend to be made. I think Democrats are going to go with the Gottheimer bill, which is a one-year extension, but cracking down on fraud and fake accounts. Now, look, as a Democrat—
But Gottheimer Fitzpatrick, right? It's the problem solvers people. So it's so they have the same plan. Okay.
Fitzpatrick's is 2 years or 3 years. Oh. Gottheimer's is one.
Okay.
But Democrats are probably going to sign on to Gottheimer in the House force that.
So to me, if you get that out of the House and go to the Senate, the thing that Democrats, there's certain times when Democrats or Republicans vote, you know exactly what's going to happen. When it talks about abortion, funding abortion, Republicans will never vote for it. And Democrats will never vote for something that, we know the stereotypes that they usually go. But I don't know that Democrats are really pro insurance companies. So what Cassidy seems to be saying is, you know, the money we're going to give to insurance companies, can we just give it directly to the people into healthcare savings accounts? I don't think that would be a problem with Democrats on the surface, because unless they're for insurance companies, this might be an alternative they can get behind. But I have not seen one speak out about it.
You're right. Nobody wants to because they want to try to save the subsidies first. And look, I'm for saving the subsidies. I think we should. But that won't ever solve the problem. Democrats are going to have to get to a place where they use Obamacare as a messaging tool, but in reality, we all kind of know we have to move on from the actual legislation 15 years ago if we're still subsidizing it to make it work.
I know. So, but the one thing you learn, Michael, is there's no way that either side will ever have a healthcare plan that's going to stick unless they work on it together. And I don't know.
Correct.
I don't know when that's going to happen.
But look, it's the same with immigration, right? We're still operating under a 1986 law. You can't executive action your way to a safe border and an immigration system. You have to make a new law.
In what way? You mean a pathway to citizenship law?
Well, I have empathy for the ICE agents and law enforcement in a way because they're just complying with the law on the books as it's written from 1986. And, you know, Biden ignored the problem and delegated it to Congress, but he's an institutionalist at its core. He believed that the only way to change that, the change to the law, was to make a new law and an update the law. Republicans are more intent on putting Band-Aids on this larger problem with the border, but it's never going to be fixed through executive action. You have to.
Well, the border is fixed, Michael. It is fixed. I mean, it's sealed. What you got to do now is how we're going to get the illegals. And then what are our border policies be for, you know, what it looks like with asylum? you know, yeah, what, but, you know, that type of thing. But right now it is sealed. I didn't think that was possible in my lifetime. He did it in like 5 months.
Right. But what happens when another Democrat becomes president? They can just reverse everything he's already done. That's my point. Same thing with healthcare. This has to be done through law, not through executive action, if we want to see permanent change to the system.
So I want you to let's talk politics, and I think you'll probably like this topic. No doubt about it, Democrats have done better in the off-year elections and the special elections, and a lot of it is because of the Hispanic vote. And I think it was front and center in Miami. Howard Enten said this, looking at a CBS YouGov poll from CNN, cut 21.
Immigration among Latinos, he is 38 points underwater. That is a 36-point shift, essentially, from where we were a year ago on immigration. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are basically tied on the issue of immigration. And now on the issue of immigration, Latinos despise, hate Donald Trump, 38 points underwater. In their mind, he is doing something absolutely wrong when it comes to immigration.
So it's not the border. It's the way you're picking up the worst first. And I think there's getting muddled. Are you really going for the worst first? Do you think that's what's happening?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, I think, because nobody understands imagery and storytelling better than the president. So I'm kind of surprised he hasn't taken his foot off the gas a little bit when it comes to sort of the amplification of the bad stories that we hear versus the good stories that ICE is catching really bad predators, really bad people. But we're hearing more about the stories of, you know, people who are doing the right thing and here for the right reasons and discompassionately being hauled off by ICE. And it's that compassion part of the policy that I think is going to hurt the Republicans. They'll be seen as less compassionate, and that will be a problem for them for sure. But we don't know if Latinos were ever... Look, they swung towards Trump, but that doesn't mean they're part of the Trump coalition forever. It takes trends. You have to see where Latinos are going. And we don't know, based on one election, what coalition they're actually part loyal to.
So let's talk about we have the Miami election. We know that. We know Virginia and New Jersey want the Democrat way. We know the election in Nashville, reasonably a 9-point win for the Republican. But for the most part, the party in power usually pays the price. Trump was asked about that yesterday, and, you know, he responded. He knows history. So here's what he said when he was asked in the Oval Office about that. And here's how it went. Do you got that number?
When you win the presidency, you seem to lose the midterms. Even if you win the presidency by a lot and you do a great job as president. You know, some presidents have done good and they've lost. I think it's like two times in the last many, many years it's been one. I don't know why. It doesn't make sense. Usually I can figure things out, but I don't know why, but that seems to be. But other than that, we should win because we're doing great.
So, I mean, he knows what history says, but he's going to try to buck that. And it's all going to come down to, is the big, beautiful bill going to pay off for putting, you know, jet fuel on the economy? By the way, the market's up 317 points. It's near another record, basically because of the rate cut.
So, look, in 2022, during the Biden midterms, it was record high inflation. I'm talking Jimmy Carter level. You remember this, right? So we were prepared to lose a ton of seats. And the Supreme Court and the Roe thing changed everything a couple months before. Events can shape midterms. They're a little bit more unpredictable. But this is it's a different electorate. And so the way Democrats approached it in 2022 was, we have to make sure the voters know that Republicans are worse than we are. And that is how we approached. We weren't always defending the Biden record. Nobody ran away from the Biden record in 2022. But we certainly made candidate quality the issue by going after the Ozzes and the Kerry Lakes and the Herschel Walkers by making them look worse or more ridiculous or more fearful of them than us. That's the way you have to kind of do that.
And yeah, it's in the.
I assume they'll follow that strategy.
They say there's about 39 seats up for grabs between empty seats and disputed seats. So they feel like in the House you're going for 39 seats. See if that number stands. Lastly, Gavin Newsom's numbers have been up 6 to 8 points. over the last month. They just did a poll in California. When I look at his track record in California, I don't get it. I mean, we know the deficit's never been higher. More people are leaving than ever before. Gas is extremely high, especially compared to the rest of the country. You know, he's got that huge deficit. Nothing's been done at Pacific Palisades. Contrast that with Shapiro. He's in his high 50s, 60s approval. Governor Beshear, I hear his numbers are around 68% approval. So why is it that Newsom would be on the top? Why is that, Michael?
Because he's doing the best out of all of the potential 2028ers at playing the TV game better, playing the media game better. He's out front more often than they are. He's going, you know, he went on Charlie Kirk's show. He debated DeSantis. He has put himself out front as this leader of the resistance. And it's really, he's done it the best out of all of them so far. I don't know if he's going to be the nominee, but that's why I think, and with the mood of the country, you know, you see Jasmine Crockett, right, in Texas, who running a campaign totally on just fighting Trump. That's sort of what Gavin Newsom is seen as nationally, the guy who's taking on Trump. And that's where mood of the country can intersect with the one voice you hear the loudest. So like in New Jersey, you know, if affordability was the real issue in that election, why didn't they blame Democrats? They've ran the state for the last 8 years, but they voted for the Democrat and for the governor overwhelmingly for Mikey Sherrill. They didn't punish the party in power there. It's that mood of the country thing that you can do everything right and say everything right. But in the end, sometimes
optics,
mood of the country, waves or whatever. I don't know if there's going to be a wave. It's too early to tell. But Democrats haven't fixed all of their problems, but they're certainly, their voters are certainly turning out. Our voters are certainly turning out in these, you know, very off year elections at a higher rate than the other side.
No doubt about it. A lot has to be at play. But as we come to the end of the year, it's important to know where everybody is. Mike LaRosa, thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks, Brian.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. Calls in a moment. Bottom of the hour, we go inside politics again, but I want to bring in the international side of it as well. And I want to get your opinions. Don't move.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
As you probably know, we've just seized a tanker on the coast of Venezuela. Large tanker, very large. Largest one ever seized, actually. And other things are happening, so you'll be seeing that later. It was seized for a very good reason.
So that was the President of the United States amping up what was going on in Venezuela, breaching their airspace with our fighter jets, and yesterday taking a tanker because they're violating sanctions. Fran, you're in Florida. Hey, Fran.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. What'd you learn from the mayor's race that was won by the Democrat?
Well, again, my opinion, but I live in South Florida. What happened is that the president, his attitude is just so, in general, so aggressive and just so cavalier with anybody who doesn't look at the stock market, number one. And I do look at the stock market. Number two, again, yet again, Republicans stayed home. And yet again, Democrats poured all kinds of money into the race, which you noted, and Republicans didn't. Republicans, I don't know what they do with their money. They stockpile it. They certainly don't, you know, give it where it needs to be.
They were outspent in Nashville, and they were outspent here 19-1 over in Miami.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Does the former administration deserve at least some of the criticism?
Well, the former administration was attempting to build the economy of tomorrow, investing in really important industries like
EVs, in chips, in areas for our national security that we've got to catch up with the rest of the world.
Were they successful at that, Governor?
What our families have said, that the Biden administration was building the economy of tomorrow, focused on EVs, chips, and other areas that we have to catch up in for our own national security. But our families were saying we need the economy of right now.
So that is Governor Beshear, who fancies himself a presidential candidate. Number one, he's got to learn to blink. He looks like Jim Harbaugh right after a big loss. So he has got 60% approval rating plus. So that's nothing to be, there's nothing to ignore. But he also said something totally ridiculous. He went on to say that since Donald Trump became president, he's closed 30 rural hospitals. I looked that up. Zero. In fact, I think since over the last 20 years, the only two rural hospitals have opened up. There's about 70 labeled as rural hospitals, 72, and I think 70 are still there. And even if Donald Trump did the worst rural hospital Medicaid cut ever, you're not going to cut 70 hospitals in 10 months. How do you do that? They say 10 were in danger of collapsing and 20 were critical. Okay, a lot different. So not even telling the truth. Josh Krasshauer joins us now on Fox and Radio's Fox News Radio's political analyst, editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. Josh, welcome back. So Governor Beshear obviously playing politics, saying Donald Trump had a great economy. He just didn't realize it.
Yeah, look, Steve Beshear, or the governor of Kentucky, is trying to kind of burnish his national credentials. He is someone who, look, I think the Democrats could use someone more moderate to speak for them. But I think that he is also getting into the game of being anti-Trump viscerally and not, you know, offering necessarily a national agenda that is going to capture the imagination of a lot of both Democratic voters and beyond. Look, there are a lot of candidates historically that are popular in their home states, and being a red state Democrat it's almost like you're extinct these days. So the fact that you do have a Democrat who's a two-term governor in Kentucky is going to get a lot of attention. I'm not sure if his ideas or if his charisma is going to translate very effectively on the national stage, but he certainly is interested in running for president.
I mean, yeah, when you're in a purple state or a red state, and you're a Democrat and your ratings are high, I think those are the types of things that qualifies you to be a serious candidate. Let's see what you got. Let's see what you did, right? I look at Gavin Newsom and I see that everything he did is touched wrong. I mean, the border broke down during his reign. You see the deficit rise. He had this crazy insurance policy where he wanted the state to insure everybody, including illegal immigrants. That fell on its face. He wanted to stop homelessness. It grew at a dizzying rate. No one's seen anything like it. He describes that oil and gas have no future. He shut down all but 8 refineries. And now you have gas that's maybe highest in the country or second highest. He's importing 65% of it from Iraq. So, I mean, this is failure, failure, failure. Like, why is he doing well?
Well, Brian, this is the dilemma the Democrats face, which is the voters, the Democratic voters, all they care about is style. All they care about is whether you can go on a podcast or go viral. The people who go viral are usually the ones who are less electable. So, Governor Beshear can talk about his recovery from tornadoes, which I think he got a lot of good grades on back home in Kentucky. Josh Shapiro, governor of Pennsylvania, can talk about rebuilding the stretch of highway that collapsed in effective time. But that's not what the Democratic base cares about these days. They don't care about competence. They don't care about having good ideas for issues. They care about who can kind of just attack Trump more or who can go viral with kind of ridiculous comments. That's why Jasmine Crockett, by the way, is now the front runner to be the Texas Senate nominee in the race that Democrats have been hoping to put in play. Doesn't look like it anymore. But the dilemma that Democrats are facing is the competent candidates, the ones who are better candidates, period, don't sell with the base. The base wants anger. They want anti-Trump. They want kind of the far left. Mamdani was another example in New York City where, like, the more competent candidates couldn't get any attention compared to someone like a socialist like Mamdani, and then he gets elected in a deep blue city. So, you know, that's the dilemma. Democrats are, I talk to a lot of Democratic strategists on a daily basis, and they're panicked because the candidates that sell in primaries, the ones who go viral, who kind of sound the most extreme, are the ones who win the nominations, and then they can't win a general election. And that's going to be a problem going forward for the party.
But you know what it sounds like? It sounds like me interviewing you 10 years ago with the Tea Party.
Yep. I mean, it's growing. I mean, look, the environment, we've talked about this, like any time you're a president in the first midterm of your administration, you're going to face challenges yourself. So it's sort of like who wants to win this? It's like that Casey Stengel quote back in the 60s. Can anyone win this game? There's an opportunity for both sides to appeal to the voters who want solutions, but neither part, the Democrats haven't really filled that vacuum right now.
I want you to, Gavin Newsom, I guess, is putting out his biography that's going to show him more likable. Cut 41.
This is not the book you'd expect me to write. Nobody's story is tidy, and I'm no different. A lot of people look at me, the stark white shirt, the blue suit, and the gelled hair, and they think, oh, I know this guy. I know this guy better than I'd ever want to know him. I get it. This is a story of a kid who always felt like he wasn't quite enough. This is a truly vulnerable book. It was incredibly hard, even painful, to write.
What's the point here?
the PR strategy, Brian, is, look, the biggest, one of the bigger vulnerabilities among others that Gavin Newsom is going to have is that he's too slick. He's inauthentic. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And so he's trying to, play act that he's actually a much different person than may come across on television. I'm not sure if that's going to be effective, but he's trying to do that with the book and obviously with the PR campaign. Look, I think the other issue for Newsom, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, Brian, but how much can style overcome the problems with major cities in California that he kind of overlooked for a long time, the homelessness issues that are still very present, the crime issues, especially, in LA and other parts of the state, the immigration issue, which is very much a hot potato right now for the Democrats. And those are the challenges that you just have to speak. That's going to be the challenge for any California Democrat that wants to run nationally. Like, their record is eventually going to get scrutinized. And how do you defend a lot of the challenges that so many cities and parts of the state have faced? And by the way, the recovery from the fires in Los Angeles, that's a big challenge. It's a huge, huge
problem. Big challenge. A year and 3 months later, you have no permits. Nobody's building. And I'm talking about really rich people who were insured. They're telling me nothing can get done. People that went and bought the land and thought they could build and just strung on their way, that can't get done because all the environmental stuff's there. The red tape he promised to cut is still very much there. Where's that? He had a chance. Every time there's a catastrophe, there's a chance to prove yourself as a leader. He's failed again. He's pointed fingers at the mayor. It's nothing to do with me. I'm angry too, he says. I just think the American people have a standard at some point.
You can fool some of the American people some of the time, but there's a lot of vulnerabilities that Newsom is going to have to overcome. Look, if you told me a year ago that Newsom was running, and I would have said he had a lot of problems, and there are more moderate Democrats that are also charismatic that can really do well. But in the what I'm hearing more and more is that if you can't go viral, if you can't attack Trump in the most visceral ways, then it's hard to make hay in the Democratic Party these days. And I will say the one thing Newsom has going for him is that he is made for TV. He is made for social media, but he's not quite as far to the left as AOC or Bernie Sanders. So if the party's gone so far left, they're looking for someone who isn't as far left as Mamdani and AOC, maybe Newsom looks better by comparison, but that doesn't mean his record has still got a whole lot of red flags.
Yeah, the other story is Kamala Harris, big story a couple of days ago, talking about how everyone don't forget about her. She sold 600,000 books. She's got a super PAC that's out there. She just sold her mailing list for $7 million back to the DNC so they can go raise money off it. And she's out there. She says, I sell out everywhere I go. And she's already a historical figure. They're making a bust of her like they do every vice president, but I don't want to slow her down. At 61 years old, she should be hitting her peak. She thinks she's hitting her peak. Do Democrats feel as though she's hitting her peak, or is she done?
I mean, those comments sound like someone who is quite insecure about their kind of what they're going to do with their life. I mean, you're a vice president. You shouldn't have to tell a New York Times reporter that. I was vice president, and they have a statue of me in Statuary Hall. Like, I don't think that is it is a sign of a confident leader and an effective leader. And it's why Democrats really had a lot of issues with her campaign and still have issues with the fact that she could be a political figure going forward. I'd be skeptical if she runs in 2028. I just think that maybe she wants to, but there are just so many hurdles, including the fact that Newsom is now passing her in the polls and seems like a much more formidable figure within California Democratic politics. So I really think her time has passed her by. If you read that interview with the New York Times, there's so many cringeworthy quotes in there that remind you why she was an ineffective candidate. in the first place. And she's, by the way, also pandering to the far left again, you know, talking about how she really wanted to be more anti-Israel, for instance, in that interview. And she couldn't because she was, you know, hemmed in by the Biden administration. I don't know how, maybe that plays in a primary, but it doesn't play with swing voters in general election states that she would need to compete in again. So I don't think the Democrats are going to be looking to Kamala Harris. She may want to get back in the game, but I don't think there's going to be much of a pathway.
And finally, when you talk about Congresswoman Crockett, Jasmine Crockett, she's coming out full blast. Ted Cruz says he loves the idea of Crockett running and says he never even met her. Let's listen. Cut 40.
That I don't know. They're both friends of mine. All three, Wesley Hunt, all three of them are friends of mine. I've endorsed all in the past. I've campaigned with all in the past. And I'm going to trust the voters of Texas because I have terrific supporters who are backing each of the three. And the voters will decide. But whoever wins the primary, they're going to beat Jasmine Crockett.
Right. Jasmine Crockett. And guess who backed out? Colin Allred, who ran against Ted Cruz, backed out to make room for her, I guess. So what's going on with Jasmine Crockett? She doesn't seem to have the skill set for a statewide win.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of insane. I mean, I always say look at the back of a politician's baseball card to see how they can perform in a big political race. And look, Colin Allred has his issues, but he ran better than Kamala Harris in Texas. He halved the margin in Texas when he ran last time. So you know he can actually win over some independent voters. I said this on Special Report this week, but Jasmine Crockett has never won a Republican or independent vote in her life. She's in a deep blue district. She speaks to the far left base or the anti-Trump base. And I have not found a Democrat who has said she has any chance of winning if she's the nominee. So, I mean, Texas is hard enough for Democrats. The Democratic Party hasn't won a Senate seat in Texas since the 1980s, Lloyd Benson. So, I mean, it's been a long time. So it's not like this was a very winnable race anyways. But there were hopes among Democrats that with a better candidate like an Allred, that Republicans would have to at least spend some money, have to actually pay attention to the race and spend some money. And that's not going to happen if Crockett's a nominee.
And real quick, Josh, I'm just struck by how many experts keep talking about Trump when they talk about Democrats. At one point, people are going to realize he's going to be gone. You're running against a past candidate. I mean, I don't remember Republicans targeting Obama when he was term limited out and it was Trump against Hillary. I really felt like Trump was going after Hillary. At one point, did they leave Trump behind and talk about what they're going to do or what their likely Republican opponent will do?
I mean, that was what bedeviled the Democratic Party in the last few elections. They didn't focus on the issues. They didn't focus on what they would do. It was strictly keeping the coalition together against Trump. And that it only can go so far, especially when you look at the Senate map, by the way, where if the Democrats do want to win the Senate, which I think is very unlikely, but you'd have to win Ohio. You'd have to win, you know, a state like Texas, right, to get the 50 seats. And they're nowhere close right now because of the way the party's moved. And then you look at the Electoral College map in 2028 and beyond that, the Democrats are going to have to sweep, you know, the blue wall states. They're going to have to actually win a state like Georgia after 2028 to actually win the presidency. So this is not a formula, this kind of base first, activist first playbook is not a formula for winning elections. It's a way to win over the base and win in cities like New York City and far left parts of the country. But to win an actual majority in the country, they're still not shown that they can make that movement.
Yeah, we'll see. They do have to something on the left to worry about, and the right has something to worry about. You know, the podcast crew seems to have really divided on Israel, really divided on Venezuela, really divided on spending it all. You know, and you know when it comes to, you know, they're not rallying around not paying for Obamacare. It just seems like there's a fracture on the right too. I just don't know what's deeper. What do you think?
Yeah, no, look, I mean, and look, J.D. Vance is not Donald Trump either. Donald Trump has immense loyalty and immense support from across the Republican spectrum. I don't think Vance has the charisma and the natural engagement that his boss does. And I think he's going to have to, you know, there are other Republicans also that may look to run in 2028, including Ted Cruz, who we just heard from. So, you know, I almost feel like looking at the state of our politics, does anyone know how to play this game? This is a wide open middle. Yeah. There's an opportunity for one party to actually take the advantage. And I think Trump has shown some signs that, you know, the 2024 election was a sign of being able to do that. I don't know if he's capitalized on that. I think there's been some mistakes made in the first year in his presidency, but Democrats are also keeping him in the game because they can't play the game either. So it's a race to the bottom.
All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate it, Josh. Always interesting. It's a fun time. Josh Krasshauer, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. So when we come back, I'll be able to take some more of your calls, 1-866-408-7669. And the decision Sylvester Stallone has made that made Philadelphia very happy.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Get out while you can. Don't get a sucker, no statue. Give him guts. I told you I wasn't going away. You got your shot. Now give me mine.
Why don't you get the hell out of here?
Shut up, old man. I ain't going nowhere.
And that, of course, is live outside our studio where Mr. T and Sylvester Stallone. No, I'm only kidding. Rocky III, classic moment. And what he's doing is standing in front of the Rocky statue. Good job, Pete. And it's the Rocky statue that's at the Philadelphia steps. It's the original. And they unveil it. They take down the veil. And Rocky, who's going to retire, and announces retirement right there. But he's avoiding Mr. T. Mr. T is the number one contender. But Mick is keeping him away from him because he does not think he can beat Mr. T. You know what that storyline's from? That storyline is Floyd Patterson, who is 185-190-pound heavyweight champion. Too light to be a champion, but very skilled. And he was trying to avoid Sonny Liston. And you know who the manager was? Customato. To me, since Stallone, I never talked to him about this. Stallone's such a student of history, boxing history. This seems like a page taken from that because Liston was trying to hunt down Patterson and dare him to fight. Patterson wasn't really afraid, but wasn't aware that, you know, what's the problem with this guy? He got in the ring and he got really knocked unconscious. And I think they had a rematch and it was up to Ali to stop Liston. They thought Liston would be a champion for the next 15 years. And Ali beat him twice. He was Cassius Clay, and then he beat him as Ali. But the bigger story is Sylvester Stallone. He said, you guys can keep that statue, but I want the original back in my place, and you get the other one. He decided, after meeting with leaders, the Philadelphia Museum gets to keep the original. And that's the point. That's the point.
There was controversy for years because they had moved it initially. It was kept by the museum, then they moved it off-site. Even in, I think it was Rocky VI, Rocky Balboa, they show you the statue, but it's off-site. And Paulie makes a joke saying, are you still upset they moved your statue? And he's like, no. You could see they wove that into the storyline.
Yeah, they moved the statue, and I don't know if he was politically correct or not. Now that he's clearly a Trump supporter, they probably want to take it out again in Philadelphia, but I think they left it iconic status. By the way, he got honored at the Kennedy Center. Sylvester Stallone has come back for another season of Tulsa King, another success story for him, which is unbelievable. Think about it. He's got The Expendables. He's got Rambo. He's got Rocky. A series of good movies that produce over and over again. I mean, why wait this long to get his honor? It blows me away. But the next one to get the honor clearly should be Gary Sinise. Should absolutely be another one. And another one that they tried to give Tom Cruise the honor, but he wouldn't accept it. Don't forget, guys, I kind of can't wait to meet you in person. February 14th in Fort Myers, Florida. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. History, Liberty, and Laughs live on stage. It's like no other show.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming here from Midtown Manhattan. Well, I'll tell you what. Somebody's here. The tourists are flooding in here. I don't know what the numbers say. I'm not sure what everybody's buying, but they are flooding the streets. They are full of Christmas-like ornaments. So across the street from Radio City, we're about one block away, two blocks away from the Rockville Center tree. We got our own tree here on Fox. Both have become big tourist attractions. This hour, we're going to be joined by Wall Street Journal's own Marian Atanasio O'Grady. She writes the America's column, which is always interesting, but now it's really important to read. She has made herself one of this nation's premier journalists when it comes to Central and South America and this place called Venezuela. So before we get to Seth Barron from the New York Post, who's in studio, author of Last Days of New York, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Immigration among Latinos. He is 38 points underwater. That is a 36-point shift, essentially, from where we were a year ago on immigration. In their mind, he is doing something absolutely wrong when it comes to immigration.
Howard Harry Enten of CNN. Are the sweeping immigration crackdowns hurting the GOP and the Hispanic community? Judging by recent elections, the answer is yes. And one prominent GOPer is starting to see warning signs and tells everyone this has been your wake-up call. We're talking about Miami.
Number two.
As you probably know, we've just seized a tanker on the coast of Venezuela, large tanker, very large.
Maybe the biggest.
Largest one ever seized, actually. Yeah. It was seized for a very good reason.
Biggest ever. Biggest tanker ever seized. We will take that tanker. Thank you very much. That's what the U.S. forces did yesterday off the coast of Venezuela to amp up the pressure on the illegitimate dictator. Will it result in a change of leadership?
Number one.
If they want a plan with a cheaper premium on the Obamacare exchange, we're just saying you want a lower premium and money for your health care up front? Choose ours. You want a $6,000 premium? Choose theirs.
Bill Cassidy, the former doctor turned Louisiana senator, healthcare crunch, an array of fixes from both parties, but no one planned to pass. As the countdown to Christmas looms, we're going to have a Republican version of the Senate, a Democratic version. Both will fail. The House is going to do something. Maybe something will pass, and maybe we'll get something done by Christmas. Seth Barron, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Brian. It's great to be here.
So let's keep this New York. We just note that Kristi Noem is getting grilled by the left and praised by the right as she sits on Capitol Hill, and they're trying to impeach, I think it's RFK and Pete Hegseth.
Right.
Which gives you an idea, by the way, what it'll be like if the House flips.
Oh, absolutely. I think we're primed for, Trump 1, Part 2.
Do you think that Democrats are in danger of focusing on Trump too much because he is term limited? And after a while, they're going to say, wait a second, that guy has left the ring?
I think that's partially why they're really into war crimes now and talking about bringing Pete Hegseth up on war crimes, J.D. Vance maybe up on war crimes. I think they really want to expand the scope of who they focus on.
Who they hate.
Yeah, who they hate. Well, or just to seed that in the mind of the public.
So, Seth, were you surprised a couple of weeks ago when Mondami goes to the White House and the president says, I'm going to give him a shout. We both want to make New York great. And the tone and tenor. It still has some people in the MAGA base upset.
Yeah, but I thought it was very clever of Trump because I feel like Mondami went in there praying that Trump was going to come at him. And Mamdani must have had a whole bunch of lines memorized, like, oh, Mr. President, this Oval Office is the people's office, blah, blah, blah. So when Trump just kind of glazed him and was like, oh, yeah, you're a great kid, it totally took the wind out of his sails. I think, and then he was just standing there kind of grinning. I think Trump played him very well. And then, you know, when he becomes mayor and starts in with his crazy stuff, you know, fighting ICE and whatnot, Trump can say, oh, you know, I thought he was a nice guy, but he's not so nice.
And then he'll get to all out Gavin Newsom like war, and Pritzker, maybe the battle. But he gave it to him. He looked at him. He's this young guy who means well. You know what? I also think he appreciated that he won, that he came out of nowhere to win. Trump likes it. There's those stories.
That's true.
So, but what we've seen so far in the transition team, what's your take?
Well, it's about as bad as one could imagine. You know, he comes in, he makes noises to try to, you know, mollify the business community and the Jewish community and the public safety people. But if you look at his transition team, I mean, he has this Alex Vitale guy who wrote a big book called The End of Policing. He's got all kinds of former criminals, anti-Semites, Muslim radicals, all over, you know, threaded throughout the entire team. So it's clear. And these are the people who are going to vet. They're not necessarily going to choose the top commissioners, but certainly the second and third tier. And those are, you know, personnel is policy.
So, you know, he's getting calls from Kamala Harris. He's getting support from Barack Obama. Is he not listening? Or did Obama go, yeah, go full socialist, go full radical, you know, or I'm going to buck what they're telling me. Bill Clinton has praised him. But that's not what those are not selections Bill Clinton would make.
No, not at all. You know, they see that this is where the momentum, this is where the energy is in the party right now. And they're willing to accept that as far as it goes. You know, everybody's talking about affordability now. I mean, he clearly struck a chord with that. I mean, needless to say, a mayor can't really do anything about making things affordable. I mean, it's not clear what that means.
They say rents are at all-time high, by the way. They just came across in New York City.
Rents are high. A lot of people want to live here. I mean, that's why. Look, a lot of the reason why you can't build more is because of regulations, and he's not going to change any of that.
You know, he told, you know, him and the president, that's one thing the president said, you know, I see scaffolding everywhere. It's so hard to build. The president knows how hard it is to build, can make it easy. And he probably says, yeah, I'll do that. But he's not.
No. I mean, what he wants to build is more public housing.
And there's about 100,000 empty apartments or more because it actually saves you money rather than live under if you're a landlord, rather than open up those apartments and deal with the maintenance in those apartments and people's complaints, I'd rather just leave them empty because you're not letting me raise the rent.
Absolutely. I mean, it costs a lot of money to rehab an apartment that's been in, you know, rented for the last 30 or 40 years to one person. But the city will not permit you to cover your costs. And they keep imposing new mandates. So for a lot of people, it's cheaper just to keep it off the market.
All right, so let's listen to Mondami. So if you're looking to see if he's going to moderate his transition team, it would leave you offended. They got a guy who spent 7 years in prison who's going to talk about prison reform. They have a woman that worships a terrorist, a cop-killing terrorist who escaped prison and went to Cuba. That's the idol. She's going to be handling schools. So there's just one kicked to the groin after another. And then there's this. A tape that he just cut for illegal immigrants to listen.
ICE is legally allowed to lie to you, but you have the right to remain silent.
If you're being detained, you may always ask, am I free to go, repeatedly, until they answer you.
You are legally allowed to film ICE, as long as you do not interfere with an arrest.
It is important to remain calm during any interaction with ICE or law enforcement. Do not impede their investigation, resist arrest, or run. One last thing. New Yorkers have a constitutional right to protest, and when I'm mayor, we will protect that right. New York will always welcome immigrants, and I will fight each and every day to protect, support, and celebrate.
He forgot to say illegal immigrants.
Right.
So why cut that tape, Seth Barron?
I mean, he's telling his base. I mean, this is a key thing for the Democrat Party in New York City and for the DSA and the whole radical, you know, pro-illegal immigrant lobby here that, you know, ICE, as we've heard, ICE is Gestapo. ICE are Nazis. We need to resist ICE, that they're kidnapping people, that they're disappearing people. Resistance against this. This is a winning point in among the left in New York City. So, I mean, he did say you can't, do things violently, but, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, and when he says he's pro the First Amendment, well, everybody is. But the First Amendment protest doesn't mean you can block traffic.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you can, march in the streets. It doesn't mean you can occupy buildings.
How about harass Jews leaving a synagogue?
You can't do that.
That happened last week.
Yes, yes. And he said, well, I'm against harassing people, but the synagogue shouldn't be in favor of violating international law, which is nonsense. His whole obsession with international law, it's essentially an out. He can say anything that he likes is pro international law, and everything else is violating it.
So, Seth Barron, our guest. Seth, the other thing that's happening, and I'm in an odd spot. At least I am really impressed with Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. Mm. I think she's a firebrand, buzzsaw. I think she knows exactly what she's doing running for governor. And I'm also really good friends with Bruce Blakeman. I think he's done a phenomenal job in Nassau County, mostly Democrat. He got 56% of the Hispanic vote. He goes to areas not just Manhasset, which, by the way, if you're listening around the country, really nice, or Brookville, unbelievably nice. He goes to Hempstead and run down areas that need help. So he's really done a good job. Your thoughts about both candidates running for the Republican nomination in a Democratic state who President Trump openly says, I'm not picking sides.
Yeah, I mean, look, this probably it wasn't, you know, what Elise Stefanik wanted to happen. But at the same time, you know, they're going to be facing a tough race. Whoever wins is going to be facing a tough race against Kathy Hochul. And, you know, maybe they need to get themselves sharpened against each other a little bit.
So I think maybe you don't know this, and don't blame yourself if you don't. But before they have a convention or a primary, there's a mini conference or something in February. So I thought this is the reason why the president's staying out of it, because they're going to resolve and find out who's got the momentum in February, I guess.
Okay.
So if that happens, you'll have a clear winner. And it's what do they look for? Donors, number one, money, number two, number three, viability.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think you're right. I think both of them are strong candidates in different ways. I mean, she's upstate, he's downstate. Look, what it comes down to is the Republican nominee has to win 35% of New York City to win statewide. And that's, you know, that's going to be tough. I don't know if either of them have the, you know, are going to have it. And it's going to be a very tough climate from everything we've heard about, you know, the Democrats.
How would you characterize Hochul's run since she's gotten her 5 years, 6 years?
I mean, Hochul is terrible. I mean, she was just chosen to be, she was picked by Cuomo just to be a woman who was unthreatening.
That could get Buffalo.
Yeah, to win Buffalo. I don't see her as a particular, I mean, she's not a strong candidate. I mean,
so that's what they see. They see a Zeldin lost by six, mm-hmm. and they think that they can be do better. Yeah, I love Zeldin. Maybe they feel they can do better. Are they right, or did Zeldin
top
catch
out.
A wave?
I think, you know, Lee Zeldin's great. You know, he kind of maybe didn't have a lot. He was maybe a little lacking in the charisma department, but, you know, that's not a bad thing necessarily. I think I don't know a lot about Blakeman. And like what, how he comes off personally, I think Stefanik has a lot of energy.
She's a buzzsaw. I mean, yeah. You saw her take apart those those Ivy League presidents
for sure. And I think Hochul is weak. It's going to depend a lot on like what the national mood is at that moment.
I think the Mondami election helps whatever a good Republican candidate emerge.
Well, sure, and we'll see what kind of stuff he gets up to in the next year. But look, Hochul married Mamdani. She came out and supported him, and then, you know, he didn't back her.
Because the lieutenant governor primarying her is a socialist.
Yes, Delgado. So she's weak, and she's going to have trouble. She's going to be tied to Mamdani. Any crazy stuff he comes up with, any, you know, crime spike that happens, she's responsible for.
Fire chief resigned.
Right.
Have you heard anything about the cops? I mean, are we going to see mass retirements? There's about 35,000 now. He says that's enough. Most people say, no, you need another 4,000.
Right. It sounds like there are going to be people leaving. I mean, if you've got your 20 years, why wouldn't you?
Right.
And I mean, he's keeping Jessica Titian for now. I just can't imagine that's going to hold up. Her whole philosophy of policing seems like to be in contradiction with what he's got. I think he's keeping her around to, like I said before, to pacify his opposition and calm down the business community. No, we're not going to let crime go wild. But I just don't see how that relationship continues.
And finally, can you make sense of the Mets? Do they want to make sure no one goes to the games?
Yeah,
Pete Alonso is now gone. They lost Diaz, their stopper. They traded Nemo, their popular player, homegrown.
Yeah, I saw Mr. Met is moving over to the Dodgers.
Yeah, I don't blame him.
I don't either.
The weather's better.
Right. I can't really fill you in on that, but it seems like, you know, this is what Mets fans live and die over, this type of thing.
All right. Thanks, Seth Barron. Thanks so much. Check out the editorial section of the New York Post. He wrote The Last Days of New York, and New York remains really intriguing. And by the way, it's a good sign for the city. You can't walk anywhere in Midtown. It is packed. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Inflation has eased significantly from its highs in mid-2022, but remains somewhat elevated relative to our 2% longer-run goal. Total PCE prices rose 2.8% over the 12 months ending in September, and excluding the volatile food and energy categories, core PCE prices also rose 2.8%. These readings are higher than earlier in the year as inflation for goods has picked up, reflecting the effects of tariffs.
Dun, 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 dun. He loves just adding that. We'll see about the tariffs. People go back and forth on the tariffs are really going to kick in and kick out in the new year. But that is Jerome Powell yesterday, who has the market rocketing up today at all-time highs because the cut rates are 0.25%. But president's not happy with that. He's like, we should have done more than that. So this is the third meeting in a row. They shifted interest rates to a new range at 3.5 to 3.75. It was a 9-3 decision. Stephen Miron, a member of the Board of Governors, just added, opposed the decision. He wanted the half-point reduction. I imagine when the president's interviewing Fed chiefs, he's saying, will you lower rates? Will you promise to lower rates? The Fed's rate cut is the news heard around the world right now. The S&P ended just yesterday, just shy of a fresh record. They passed it today. We'll see how long it lasts. I think that this is another thing that people bring up. Because there was a government shutdown, they don't have complete data on jobs or in anything. So a lot of people thought they would punt, not a lot, some, thought they would punt because they don't have the data and use that as an excuse and just wait for the new year. But when the data comes in, what will it show? It'll show job loss, but also show job gains. So they expect it'll be the unemployment will be 4.4%, which is dealable. What they say is that if you think inflation's under control, you can cut rates. If it's not, you bring the rates up in order to get people to stop spending to bring the inflation rate down. Got it. However, if you feel as though jobs are in jeopardy, you might not cut rates. If you feel as though you want to stimulate the economy, that's what you do. Remember, we were at zero for a while, so people got kind of spoiled. But now we're getting to the point where I think if the banks respond and they don't wait for the 10-year yield, if they respond to this like they used to, rates are going to drop again. So if rates for you and me to go get a mortgage to buy a house or to improve my house, to go take out a loan, an equity loan, if the rates are decent, then it's going to affect me. Also, does it affect credit cards that are like 20, 25% credit cards? So can you get that credit card number down? That helps people on every level. So gas prices helps people at every level, as well as interest rates. It hurts people. It helps people at every level. But the bank's got to play the game. This is where the president could come in. He knows all these bankers. He has them over all the time. Constant dialogue. He gave them a seat at the table. Guys, I need you to lower rates. I need people to be able to take out an auto loan so they can write it off. But they won't take it out if it's 7, 8%. You get him 5 or 6%, I can open up the floodgates here. And he'll work with everybody. He takes something in the macro and he makes it personal like nobody else. Why? Because he loves it. He loves the business element of being president.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
How could this escalate the conflict with Venezuela?
Well, you know, we've had sanctions on Venezuelan oil since the first Trump administration.
And Biden kept them.
Kept them.
Yeah.
So to me, this is absolutely normal. I mean,
seizing an oil tanker?
Yeah. We've been seizing Iranian oil tankers in the past. We also, according to the law that I've read, that oil is up for forfeiture. So we could keep that. We've kept Iranian oil in the past. I think this is actually a pretty, you know, check the box case.
Mm-hmm. So that's an astonished Jake Tapper talking to his own national security analyst on the taking of a Venezuelan Iranian tanker yesterday. And we saw the video. It's out there and available. Mary Antonatio O'Grady joins us now. She writes the America's column, a weekly column on the Wall Street Journal. It talks about politics, economics, but focuses on Latin America and Canada. And of course, it's always important stories, but now more than ever, the world is watching what's next in Venezuela. And Mary's all over this. Mary, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. It's Anastasia. Very famous Irish name, a very Irish name.
So very Irish. So, Mary, in particular, what do you think this taking of the tanker does for the tensions in the region?
Well, I think it's an excellent move by the president. The president wants to, I mean, he starts out talking about drugs, but I think it's pretty apparent that what he wants to do is he wants to see Maduro gone. There's a legitimately elected president of Venezuela. He's in exile in Spain right now. And President Trump wants to see him return and the democracy to be restored. And when it comes to that agenda, I think the president is trying to avoid bombing Venezuela or any harsh military action. And one of the best ways to make life more difficult for the dictatorship is cutting off the money. So I think it's a good move, and I think it's a legitimate move. I mean, apparently the flag that it was flying was not authentic. It was flying a Guyanese flag, which Guyana says is the ship was not registered there. So, follow the money and cut off the money. That's what we do with when sanctioned oil is being shipped around the globe.
How much support does Maduro, where is Maduro support?
Well, it's a military dictatorship, right? So he has control of the weapons and the military, particularly at the top. They're beneficiaries of all the gangster businesses that the government is, that the dictatorship is in, mostly drug trafficking, but all kinds of other businesses. And those generals are beneficiaries of that. So that's where he has control. And then they have a very effective counterintelligence network that basically is assigned to the barracks and to watch over mid-level officers and make sure that nobody steps out of line. You know, they have about 850, I think, political prisoners in Venezuela, and more than 170 of them are members of the military. So this very repressive counterintelligence network basically surveils the barracks and all the different military installations constantly looking for anybody who might be stepping out of line. So that's how they control the lower ranks of the military, and the upper ranks of the military are on the payroll of the regime, so they stay in line. And that's basically his support. I don't think among the public he has much support at all at this point.
Right. He's surrounded by Cubans?
There's a lot of Cubans who do intelligence. I mean, that's the strongest. Cuba is really bad at everything, which is why the country has fallen apart. But they're very good at intelligence and spying and that sort of thing. And so they have a pretty strong network inside the country that is either actively working or has trained the Venezuelans who are working for Maduro.
What would get his attention to get him out? Where and what are his likely landing spots? But people tell me Turkey.
Yeah, Turkey's one. I mean, I think, first of all, to get him out, I don't know what's going on there, but I would suppose that he wants safe passage, and he wants safe passage for, say, 20 people around him. It's not enough just for him. And then he also has a problem because he would be subject to law enforcement actions from the International Criminal Court. And Donald Trump, I don't think, can give him any guarantees about that. So he'd have to go to a country that would protect him from the ICC. Turkey would be one of them. Moscow, Tehran, those kinds of places that aren't going to turn him over because the ICC right. comes after him. And where he would go is, I mean, think about it for yourself. If you wanted to... if you were going to go into exile from your country, I don't think you'd want to go to Tehran or Moscow, but maybe Turkey's not such a bad choice.
Edward Snowden seems to be happy. Assad, I don't hear from him much anymore.
So that's right.
Yeah, Mary O'Grady, our guest. So we've been watching this before, him push to the brink, and he ends up staying, or we get frustrated and we do a deal with him. But I don't think the president can afford this guy to stay in power. I know we can't go out and say that. We don't do regime change. But what do you think could be the thing that ousts him, that shows him he has no choice, besides losing control of the army, which the way you're stating it, he has not lost yet, even though the CIA is on the ground there. What's the thing that would push him over?
Well, you know, that's just very tough to know.
Well, I have a better question then. What would it look like? What would the region look like without him, with the exile leader in power? Tell me what it means.
That's easy. I mean, I think that if Venezuela falls, the region would look fantastic because it's been such a destabilizing effect throughout the region. I mean, starting with the migration. You know, if you talk to Venezuelans, I wrote my column about the Chilean election. There's a lot of Venezuelans in Chile. They all want to go home. These people want to go home. This idea that they are migrating in some kind of protest against the United States or somehow coming here to destabilize us, they're coming here because they have no options. And, you know, we talk a lot. I think it was Giorgia Meloni, the Italian prime minister, who says, you know, we talk a lot about the right to immigrate, but what about the right to stay home? And this would give Venezuelans the right to live in their own country again. So that's really important. As far as what would push him over, I think the president is trying to avoid any kind of kinetic strike inside Venezuela, but that may turn out to be necessary because I agree with you. I mean, there's no way at this point that Donald Trump can back off. He's made a commitment, and if he says all of a sudden, you know, we're going home, that's going to be seen as a big victory for Maduro, and, you know, it'll empower him. So I think we have to finish the job. Exactly how we finish the job is hard to say, but that's why, coming back to this oil tanker, you know, they don't pump as much oil as they used to, but they still rely a lot on their Venezuelan exports through, you know, the black market. And if we start cutting those options off, it's, you know, their sanctioned oil traveling around the globe, that's going to hurt a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think the administration's hope is that pushing a little bit further all the time with moves like this will eventually convince him that there's no way that he can stay and be stable. So he's better off going.
So people say, Mary, we don't do regime change well. Look at Iraq, look at Libya. But some say this is different. I mean, this guy lost an election and won't leave. So you can't say they're ousting a legitimate leader. And he's been in power, and you've already outlined the upside of him going. But do you think that this has a chance to get really messy should they get him out?
Well, I totally agree with you that, you know, it on the surface, it appears that it would have a good outcome because the majority of the people in the country want him gone. The majority of the intelligence tells us that the majority of the military want him gone. They want to return to the democracy, not the leadership, not the spies that Cuba has sent over there. But the majority of the rank and file would be happy to basically stand up a military that defends the democracy. However, I do think that when you're going down a path like this, you have to think about the worst case scenarios. You know, you have to think about what if we're wrong? And, you know, it's not as clean as that. There are some problems, including, you know, a lot of illegal groups that operate there that may not back off so easily. That would be like the ELN, which is a Colombian narco-terrorist group. It would include the Cartel de Soles, which is the group that is accused of being linked to the regime. It would include Tren de Agua. There's a lot of people with, you know, they're irregulars and they have weapons. So any move to, you know, where he actually leaves has to contemplate a certain amount of chaos on day one. But we've heard from, and we had a piece in the Journal last week from members of the of Maria Corina Machado's group who say that they think that the concern about chaos is overrated, that there is a much stronger support for a free Venezuela than anyone anticipates, and that that's not a good reason to back off. So I think, while I think we have to anticipate problems, you know, and I think the U.S. has to kind of help without committing troops, obviously, but help as an advisor with intelligence and so forth to get them stabilized. But I think it's a gamble worth taking because the alternative is the mess that we have all over South America, and Venezuela is at the heart of it.
Yeah, and good. Maybe finally Cuba will be dislodged from that brutal regime because they'll have almost no allies in the region then, right?
Good point. Yeah, excellent point.
Mary, you got to go. Thanks so much for the quality time. We look forward to your columns now more than ever.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Have a great weekend.
You too. That is the Wall Street Journal. I want to go to the phone, see if I can squeeze in some calls before we get to more to know after the break. Hank in Virginia. Hey, Hank.
Hey, Brian. How you doing? Merry Christmas.
Same to you.
Listen, I'm a big Trump supporter, but this whole thing about Ukrainian is the war. It's really a Russian invasion, and words do matter. I understand Ukraine's corrupt, but they need to set up something like the Marshall Plan. They call it the Trump Plan. And then release that money from the Belgian banks. And don't worry about the saber rattling. What is Russia going to do, invade Belgium? And then release some of these Tomahawk missiles. And then you put the screws to Putin.
Thank you, Hank. You're singing my song exactly. Absolutely. And, you know, we're asking for Zelensky to cave. Nothing of Putin. and you saw Lavrov came out and he said, I appreciate President Trump, but I really don't like the sanctions he put on me. Oh, really? So they also want land they haven't won yet? Oh, are you kidding me? In the Donbass? How many people have died to make sure they kept that portion of the Donbass? There's no way they're going to do that. However, there's certain things they will give. They're not going to get back. And they have to be able to put an international force in there, join the EU next year. So that'll be important. But it is important to point out the good guys have to win once in a while, even if they're imperfect. And they got to win now. And Russia cannot walk away with anything but a loss. They should be embarrassed by their performance, their invasion, their decisions. Barry in Los Angeles. Barry.
Yeah, Brian. First of all, the L.A. fires were 11 months ago, not a year and 3 months ago.
My bad.
Number, you know what else is 11 months ago?
What?
Or 11 months from us? The midterms. Please stop talking about the midterms. The only polls mean nothing right now for the midterms 11 months away. The only thing that matters in the next, between now and the August recess, is that Republicans govern conservatively as they were elected to do.
Barry, I think you're right. Performance is everything. But I think I think it's wrong to just say, off your elections, that was odd. Oh, no one showed up. Oh, Miami, what can you do? I think that's wrong, too. I think you look at the numbers, you see the turnout, you find out what's bothering people, what's not, and then you go. The affordability thing, Barry, snuck up on the president. And what they did in New York maybe resonated with the country. But appreciate the call.
His mouth to your ears. It's Brian Kilmeade. More to know.
Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
So I know we've been talking a lot about the headlines, and I get it. I love it as much as anyone. Iraq, Ukraine, and Venezuela, and what's going on with this political process. The president and the economy, affordability. There's a raging fight right now in Capitol Hill with Kristi Noem going against Democrats when it comes to illegal immigrants. But I just think you need to know more. And here we go. Sylvester Stallone has decided to let Philadelphia keep the original Rocky statue. This was controversy. At first they moved it. He was upset about it. Then he said, okay, you can keep it now. And now that you put it back, but I'm going to eventually want it back. He's in his 80s now. But now he made a decision after meeting with Philadelphia leaders. That decision is, you know what? You can keep it. Keep the original. My hope is they never move it. I mean, he's clearly said that Donald Trump is like George Washington. Pretty sure that every Democrat in America threw up in their mouth when they heard that.
Yeah, but I always thought it was a bad move by the museum for moving it because they said, you know, it wasn't a true artistic type of a thing that's worthy. But it would bring people into your museum knowing that a lot of people visit the statue. Hey, there's a museum there. Maybe I'll go in and check out what's in there. It would bring in customers, so to speak.
I mean, get people who are boxing fans to look at ancient art.
Yeah. Yes. Right.
Or Benjamin Franklin's novel.
Well, if you're there, it's right. I mean, literally, it's a step away.
Next. Well, get this. This is huge. He's now the ex-Michigan football coach, and he's in jail after getting fired over an allegation of inappropriate relationship. So he gets fired after an investigation for an inappropriate relationship. Okay. Hours later, and there's some problems here that we can't fill in the blanks yet. Sharon Moore then is charged with alleged assault. It's so clear they first detain him and then they send him to jail. He's in jail right now. So from coaching in a bowl game, making the playoffs, right? No, go to the Citrus Bowl, playing against Texas, to going there. To finishing a 9-3 season, had a good half against Ohio State and then got crushed. Beat Ohio State the year before. An up-and-coming star coach. He is now in jail. I've never seen a fall like this. Of course, he's got three kids, a family, and everything.
Yep. I mean, that's the thing with the family. And it's a different situation, but it reminds me of what happened with the gambling. You're coaching in the NBA, and then all of a sudden you're in jail for
Chauncey Billups.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. There you go. Next, Taylor Swift is firing back with four-word messages to critics who tell her to go away. The singer calls 2025 a good year after getting engaged and reclaiming her master tapes, not a master's degree. She was on with Stephen Colbert last night and talked about her career, talked about her marriage. She's 35 years old. She seems to be in a great relationship. But let's be honest. I mean, since they got engaged, the Chiefs have gone from Super Bowl winners to Super Bowl finalists to not making the playoffs, let alone getting in as a wild card. This more than likely not making the playoffs. Do you think that's linked at all? Have they done tests on this?
I mean, with Kelce getting older and some key players getting older, it could just be a massive coincidence. But you know what? She's got the attitude. You know what? You got to let the critics just roll off your back. Like, who cares what they say? Just, you know what? You're successful. That's the ultimate sticking
right.
point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, come on, please. She's fantastic. I'm never going to go see a concert, but I appreciate the success and the work ethic. Next, the NFL makes massive time-saving change to the 2026 draft. That's the headline. You know what they did? The time in between making a draft pick is from 10 minutes to 8 minutes. And they think it's going to save, it's a four-hour show. They think it's going to save a lot of time in the four-hour show. They will shave off an hour off the festivities. Just like making people make a decision in 8 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Brian Kilmeade Show.